Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Doug Bernard, sitting in this week for Carol Castiel. Our guest on this edition, Shane Harris. He's senior correspondent at The Daily Beast and also author of the recently published book, At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. 2014 may well be remembered as the year computer hacks went mainstream. The year began with attacks on retailers, leading to the theft of millions of credit card numbers, and ended with an even more high-profile hack at Sony Pictures Entertainment and international intrigue over who was responsible. If one thing's clear, 2015 promises even more of the same. Shane Harris has been writing about cyber attacks for over a decade. We'll talk with him about the Sony hack, the broader complexities of cyber attacks, and related issues in his new book. Shane Harris joins us at the VOA Broadcast Center here in Washington. Shane Harris, welcome to the program. When Admiral James Stavridis stepped down as the NATO Supreme Allied Commander in 2003, VOA asked him what he thought NATO's top challenge is. He had one word answer, cyber. What do you think he meant by that?
I think what he meant was the ways that the United States is going to be vulnerable to cyber attack and cyber espionage in the years to come. And I think that's probably largely come to pass. Just right now, as we're talking, we're in the midst of this attack on the Sony Corporation. The president has gone back and blamed North Korea for this. It's become an international incident. Chinese espionage against American corporations is widespread and rampant. We know from now official testimony from national security officials that the computer systems that regulate our electrical power grid that are connected to the internet have been penetrated by outside organizations. It is definitely the case that cybersecurity and defending the country against a major attack has become sort of the central preoccupation of national security officials. And looking at that from Stavridis' perspective at NATO, we're also seeing countries around the world, by last count from the Pentagon, 60 countries that are developing some sort of offensive cyber capability.
So using that military language, in effect, for years it seems like we've been hearing about, quote, the coming cyber war. My question to you is, has it already come and we just perhaps haven't labeled it as such or don't know it yet?
Yeah, I think, you know, we're in it, aren't we? I mean, we're in multiple cyber conflicts, if we want to put it that way, of varying degrees. I kind of sort of draw a spectrum of this in the book where I say, you know, on one end you have sort of spying and espionage, and on the other more extreme you have attacks that are meant to do physical damage in the real world. And we've seen instances and examples of all kinds of different operations along that spectrum. Certainly the kinds of attacks that are being leveled against Sony right now where data is being stolen and information is being exposed, that has been happening for years. I don't think people just really haven't kind of, you know, reckoned to it publicly the way our national security officials privately have been much more attuned to this over the past, you know, 5-6 years, I would say.
So how prepared in general do you think the United States is to defend itself?
Not very well against a catastrophic attack, that's for sure. It is still the case that experts will tell you that the electrical power grid, critical information systems in the country are not sufficiently protected. For a long time, I think we felt that the banking system, the financial networks were pretty well protected, but then recently JP Morgan was the victim of a really aggressive hack. Part of the problem here is that, you know, the internet as we conceive of it is not a single thing. I mean, the internet as it exists just in this country, the collection of servers and equipment and pipes and what Ted Stevens called the series of tubes is a collection of networks that are 85% owned by private entities. They're not centrally regulated. So managing that, defending that is incredibly difficult. Companies are just not protected enough, and it really is up to companies to protect these networks, and that's why the government finds to be such a challenge to do national cyber defense. About 7 years ago, there was a series of aggressive and concerning data breaches at U.S. defense companies. contractors.
This was the Chinese, what's been linked to the Chinese, the theft of basically sensitive information regarding the construction of a new aircraft.
Yeah, the Joint Strike Fighter, exactly, which is the most expensive military weapon system we've ever had. And in 2006 and 2007, spies believed to be in China were just siphoning off reams of information about this program from the contractors who were building it, not the Air Force that managed it, but the contractors who work for the Air Force. And in that case, the government was able to come in and effectively say to those companies, you know, either you raise your security or you're not going to be contractors anymore. There was a very powerful incentive the government had there that it could lean on them. Mm-hmm. But that's not the case with a company like, take Sony or Home Depot or Target. And the government, it's not easy for them to go in and simply say, you will do this or else. We don't regulate internet security the way we regulate safety at, you know, chemical plants and food production facilities. We just don't do that. We might, but we're not doing that now.
I'd like to turn to the example of Sony and the alleged role that North Korea played in just a moment. But first to your book. The title is At War. That seems to be very clear, ampersand war. The subtitle raises a question. The subtitle is The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. What are you referencing there?
Well, certainly I'm calling out to the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower talked about in his farewell speech when he left the White House. But the military-internet complex, as I define it, is sort of alliance between, on the one hand, the U.S. military and the intelligence agencies, principally the National Security Agency, which is our sort of center of gravity of cyber operations in the government. Them on the one hand, and on the other, technology companies, to include giants like Google and Facebook, the telecommunications companies, companies that run the internet backbone in the United States, the ones who effectively own and operate or control the networks, mm-hmm. the thing that we are trying to protect and the thing that the military and the intelligence community is trying to operate offensively inside of. And this alliance coming together for the purposes of basically conducting operations in cyberspace, waging a new kind of warfare and battle in cyberspace.
In fact, in the preface, I believe, or the first chapter, you write of what you call a turning point in terms of unifying or bringing together these elements of government authority and power and corporate authority and power. What was that turning point?
There are two sort of key moments where it happened. One is right after the 9/11 attacks. You certainly see the government turning to private telecommunications companies and saying, you all have the data that we need about terrorists. You have the communications data. We need to access it. We're going to have to work together. And I think the other big turning point was, we talked earlier about this massive theft of military information by China from defense mm-hmm. contractors. This was a moment where the government suddenly realized that its secrets were not locked down inside of its own computers, right? Their secrets were out there in the hands of the contractors working for them, and that to protect vital information, we were going to have to protect companies that held that information. And so these two sides come together, these military contractors and the government, to sort of launch a kind of partnership and alliance that I really think kind of gives rise to the current, you know, incarnation that we have of this military internet complex.
You also write about various threats that are out there, both in terms of things that can happen and those who may perpetrate them. What do you think are the largest threats in the cybersphere now? And I'm talking both about actors, be they nation states or unaffiliated groups or who knows, and also the things that can happen.
Yeah, I think that there's probably a couple of categories of big threats right now. I mean, one is certainly financial fraud and theft. I mean, this is something that we have a lot more, I think, as generally as citizens are more familiar with, your credit card number getting stolen. You know, if you went to Home Depot or Target in the past 2 years, you probably had a new ATM card or debit card sent to you. But if we're really talking in a national security context, I think we have to talk about weaknesses in the systems that regulate critical infrastructure in this country. So the power grid, public utilities. Those are, I think, woefully unprotected right now. And not only is it within the realm of possibility that a foreign government or even a criminal organization could knock out the power to a certain city or region by penetrating those systems. President, the director of the National Security Agency, numerous officials have come out to say it's already happening, that people are probing those systems. These systems are exposed, and if somebody really wanted to do great damage to us, they could do it, and we're not defending against it properly right now. 2009, President Obama comes in, and the first major speech he gives on cybersecurity, he talks about an actual blackout that was caused in a foreign country, which he didn't identify. Most people believe it was Brazil, that now many experts believe was a real instance of hackers shutting off the lights in a city. So here you had the president of the United States standing up and saying, this kind of thing is real. It has happened once before. It could happen to us here. And it kind of moved from out of the realm of science fiction into being a real, legitimate national security concern that caught the attention of the president of the United States. It was remarkable. What's so interesting about warfare now in this domain is that it is comparatively trivial to field a cyber force than it is to go out and build a physical army or a navy. I mean, countries that are never going to be able to challenge us militarily are going to be able to go toe-to-toe with us in cyberspace. The barrier to entry is so much lower on that battlefield.
People have often used the term here, asymmetric, yeah. That you could have, say, let's take an example of Ukraine and Russia. Here you have, in conventional military terms, two very unmatched, unequal potential adversaries. But in the cybersphere, Russia certainly has a lot of resources, but so does Ukraine too, and they can really sort of punch up above their weight.
Yeah, absolutely. I take Iran, a good example of this. I mean, Iran has been very aggressive in the past 2 years with attacks on the U.S. banking system, our websites, mainly not the actual physical data facilities. They're believed to be behind an attack on an oil company in Saudi Arabia that wiped data off those computers. You know, a country like Iran can punch above its weight as well, going out and antagonizing the United States.
Right.
And Ukraine certainly is. I mean, look, Ukraine has been a center of cyber criminal activity for years. There are a lot of very smart computer engineers and hackers in that part of the world. That expertise and that knowledge is mobile, and you can conduct these operations remotely from wherever you are. So if you're somebody who has these skills, you can be sitting in Eastern Europe and, you know, conducting attacks in the Middle East. It knows no boundaries in that way.
If the internet, the global internet, is to some ways becoming more militarized, what do you consider to be the natural advantages that the United States has? Because certainly, as other countries are gearing up, the United States is gearing up as well, and clearly not just in a defensive mode either.
Yeah, we have the advantage of reach, I guess I would call it. The ability to get inside the communications and the data networks of countries all over the world. And this is principally work conducted by the National Security Agency. It is a global surveillance organization. It exists in large part to gather up communications and data wherever they reside and wherever they're moving on the planet. Now, that ability to get inside a computer system and see what's going on is the next step to that is to take control of it. To damage it, to possibly cause damage in the physical world, something that it's connected to. So we have that advantage of reach. We also have the advantage of expertise. We have the smartest, most sophisticated computer engineers and hackers anywhere in the world. Most of them work in private industry. Not all of them are working for the government. But we have a level of expertise as well. So reach and expertise and innovation are really the things that are going to give us our advantage in that.
Is it also an advantage that most of the world's traffic, data traffic, flows at some point through the United States? And I say this because, you know, it's easy to think of, say, sending an email to someone, like perhaps picking up a phone. There is a line, a physical line, that is now connecting the two of us, but the internet does not work in that way at all.
Absolutely. I mean, most of the internet traffic passes through the United States. I mean, if you are sending an email from Turkey to Italy, it's entirely possible that that communication is separated into packets and then routed through the United States at the speed of light and then reassembled at its destination. That, for years now, has given us the ability to monitor global communications from right here inside the United States, and that gives us an advantage in cyberspace as well. You know, it's interesting, in sort of the post-Snowden and the aftermath now, a lot of countries are talking about moving their internet infrastructure in a way that that traffic isn't routed through the United States. That's going to be easier said than done. But to the extent that that happens and that you see traffic dropping off as it moves through this country, that means that we have to work, our intelligence agencies have to work even harder to go get that information. But it's absolutely the case that we are sitting sort of at the crossroads of the global communication system, and that gives us an extraordinary advantage and rare opportunities in cyberspace.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is journalist Shane Harris. He's author of the recently published book, At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. I'm Doug Bernard, sitting in for Carol Castiel. This quick reminder that we want to hear your thoughts on today's topic. Please write to us at pcusa@voanews.com. You can also subscribe to our free podcast. Just click on the iTunes button at our website, voanews.com/PCUSA. And you can also follow me on Twitter, at DFrontiers, and connect with Current Affairs programs on Facebook via facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA. And here's a shout-out to loyal listener Ibrahim Ahmed Gagne from Yola, Nigeria. Shane Harris, let's turn to the Sony hack, if we can. And I'm speaking specifically of Sony Entertainment Pictures, not the repeated hacks that have been following the PlayStation and whatnot. Not a good year for Sony. How have you been seeing this? I'm curious what you're seeing as this has played out publicly before us.
Yeah. Well, it certainly is the most high-profile, I think, hack that we've ever had in the United States. We had the Target breach, the Home Depot breach, but this involves movies, it involves celebrities, it involves, you know, this mysterious foreign dictator. I mean, it kind of has all of the makings of a film, actually, which is sort of, you know, bizarre that these two worlds are colliding. But what I'm seeing here are a couple of things I'm watching. One is that the FBI and President Obama came out relatively quickly and attributed this solely to the actions of North Korea. The evidence that they have presented to date publicly is pretty thin. It's quite circumstantial. I think even they would agree that, you know, it can be disputed, which leads a lot of people, myself included, to presume, to conclude that they must have some much more persuasive and compelling and secret evidence that they're not showing because they don't want to tip their hand to it.
Mm-hmm. They made a veiled reference to that.
They have. They've talked about sources and methods, and they can't say anymore, which, I mean, again, is what you would expect them to say. But it is certainly the case that we have never seen the President of the United States come out in this way, directly point the finger at a country, hold it responsible. And this is taking things, elevating it to a new level. And not only that, but he promised, his words, proportional response. In other words, we, the United States, are going to take some action for this cyber attack against a company. This wasn't against, you know, a military base. This wasn't against a government computer. This wasn't against a public utility. It's an entertainment company. And I think that the implications of that we're just sort of beginning to wrestle with. I mean, first we're getting past the question of the attribution and is the case solved or not. But then, I mean, think about this. I mean, this is the government saying we are going to respond for what basically amounts to a theft of a company. I mean, you know, no one was killed. This isn't espionage. Movies were stolen.
People
were
embarrassed
and humiliated, you know, and now everyone, you know, knows what Amy Pascal thinks of Angelina Jolie. And but the President of the United States says we're going to respond to that? That's extraordinary.
Well, extraordinary, and I think perhaps worrisome, at least for some people. President Obama referred to it as an act of cyber vandalism, I believe. Others have upped the language. It seems to me this is more than just a semantic difference. If a nation state or even a non-state, you know, a terrorist group, Al-Qaeda or something, lobs a missile at you, you pretty much know who's responsible, and then you can begin to figure out how to respond. But when it comes to these cyber attacks and hacks, attributing, you know, actual definitive blame is very tricky, and that just seems to be very worrisome when you're talking about responding to another nation.
Yeah, it absolutely is. I mean, attribution, most experts will say, is the toughest part of the sort of the postmortem of any attack, knowing who did it, where they came from. In the Sony case, we know we can trace back the source of the attack to a series of internet protocol addresses that are, many of them were what are known as proxy servers. And what these basically are just gateways that lots of criminals on the internet use in order to mask where they are actually physically located on the planet. I write in the book that the government has actually become behind the scenes a lot better at attribution than experts will give them credit for. And I'm wondering, and one of the things you asked me what I'm watching for in this case is, okay, is it the case that there is, you know, unmasking technology or attribution technology that the NSA or the FBI has at its disposal that it's now bringing to bear here that is giving them a high level of confidence that North Korea did this? I just can't believe that based on the public evidence they've presented that they would ever let the President of the United States go on TV and say North Korea did it, because it's just too easily refutable. So the question then becomes, have we actually gotten really good or a lot better to the point where we're comfortable engaging in a retaliatory strike based on what probably is information that is not entirely airtight? And if that's true, that's also a remarkable evolution.
So what are the rules of the road for cyber attacks and cyber war? And I'm thinking back to your book, At War, you relate of a story of, I think it was in 2010, a war game scenario that was played out.
Yeah. So this is a war game called the Schriever War Game. It's the military conducts this every year where they try and take some, you know, big new problem that is going to be defining the future of war. And this year that it was cyber attacks. And there was a, you know, a red team, blue team, the U.S. playing the blue, and the red is an adversary, presumed to be North Korea or China if you read how the game went, although they never specify. But what happened is the adversary launches cyber attacks on the command and control systems of the blue force, and they don't know how to respond because they can't tell whether or not this is a provocative act, whether it's an attack, where on the spectrum of aggression does it fall. It's not like in a naval battle where, you know, if the fleet moves a certain way and you interpret this as a sign of hostility or warning, that's called signaling. Well, there's no signaling in cyberspace. And what they learned very quickly was that we got to have some rules of the road, not just for us, but for other nations that we might be doing battle with, because what one nation might be launching as a sort of more harmless, sort of provocative kind of gesture, the other one might interpret as a full-on assault.
The potential for catastrophic results here seems to me quite large.
Yeah, I think that it is. And it makes me actually wonder, I mean, now that I'm thinking about the Sony case, whether or not it was maybe President Obama did something quite smart by coming out and saying, okay, we think it's North Korea, we're going to take proportional response. It's a very carefully chosen word. It has a legal context under international law and law of armed conflict that says, okay, you did this thing to us. Now we're going to do something to you that is proportional. What that really means is, okay, you attack Sony and expose some emails. We're not going to come bomb you, right? But we are going to do something to your computer systems that doesn't cause physical damage.
A form of signaling in itself.
Absolutely. And if that's the case, and if this is what we did, and it kind of stops there, this maybe does start to help shape what those rules of the road and those norms are going to be. Because right now, there's really no hope that I think that countries of the world, particularly countries like North Korea, are going to gather around the table and come up with some kind of Geneva Convention for cyber warfare. We're just not there yet. So in these instances in which a country announces that it's going to take some retaliatory measure against another, it's extremely important that we do that within at least the framework of how we understand the law of wars in a conventional or kinetic sense. And if we are responsible for the internet outages in North Korea, as many people think that we are, then we probably did stay within the lines. And that does sort of establish a norm. Shutting off the internet in North Korea, and it only affects probably a few thousand people who actually have internet access in North Korea anyway, seems to me to actually be a proportional response to what happened in the Sony case.
What makes for a good cyber warrior, if such a person exists?
I think it's a combination of, you know, for they have to be a good hacker. And hackers get a bad rap. I mean, a hacker is somebody, I think, who has kind of a combination of an engineer and an artist's mind at the same time and can look at a piece of machinery and understand what it was designed to do, but then figure out all the ways it can be manipulated to do something else. So most of the ones that are working in the military today are coming from backgrounds in math and physics, computer science, engineering. But, you know, the ones who I've met who I think are really the most impressive are ones who can think creatively and who can sort of anticipate three or four steps ahead in a situation and bring not just their engineering skills to bear, but also that kind of creative mindset and thinking. That's what makes somebody a great hacker, is how do you get inside the system and figure out how to sort of re-engineer it. And you know, look, the skills that it takes to be at the very, very high end of people who are working for the National Security Agency and are being deployed to get inside the really hard to reach computer systems and the really hard to reach data systems, it takes perseverance, skill, it takes a lot of time. I mean, we talk about attacks happening at the speed of light, but the planning for things like this can take weeks, months, if not years.
I use the term cyber warrior. I don't know if that term exists, but at several points in your book, At War, you write about somebody named General Keith Alexander. Who is he, and why does he figure so prominently here?
Well, Keith Alexander was the director of the National Security Agency up until last year, the longest-serving director of the agency, a four-star Army general who also became the head of what's called U.S. Cyber Command, which is the new command in the military where all of our cyber forces are coalescing. Alexander really led the NSA through this transformative period when it went from being a global intelligence gathering organization to a cyber warfare organization, one capable of breaking into systems, causing physical damage, writing software code that was able of causing real destruction. I'm thinking here particularly the attack known as Stuxnet on the Iranian nuclear centrifuges going back to 2007. Alexander was somebody who came up in the intelligence field all through his military career. Very, very unusual that somebody who specializes in intelligence becomes a four-star general. It's almost unheard of. And he was a real visionary and believed in the power of the internet and of networks, and both to as a place to gather information about your adversaries, but also cause real-world effects. Kinetic operations, as they like to call them in the military. He saw
things that go boom.
Things that go boom, absolutely. And he saw cyberspace as a battlefield and led the NSA through that period and oversaw its cyber offensive operations in Iraq, which were a big, big part of why we were able to quell the violence of the insurgency in Iraq. I think he, in many ways, transformed not just the way that the NSA exists as our sort of center of gravity of cyber operations, but also arguably helped shape the way that we're going to fight wars in the future.
If the internet has a militarized component to it, how then do you evaluate the Snowden leaks?
That's a hard question.
That may actually ask you to step outside your role as journalist for a moment.
Yeah. I think that there's no question that, you know, the Snowden leaks were extraordinary in their volume and in their insight. I mean, we've never seen this much kind of a glimpse into the inner workings and the mechanics of global surveillance. I mean, very, very technical in many ways. I mean, it's kind of astonishing to me as a journalist. You know, I don't know if it were two or three years after 9/11, I don't know that most of this stuff would have been published. We're far enough away from it now that I think we want more daylight and not less. But there was a real time for a while where journalists were very hesitant about publishing secrets. You know, I think that it probably has to some degree made it harder for the NSA to do what it does. There are those, and I've interviewed many people, who believe that Snowden set back our capabilities and that he's done real damage. I'm not in a position to evaluate that. But what I can say is that it certainly put the NSA in a position of having to come forward and talk much more openly about how it operates in this space, how it sees the future of warfare, what responsibilities it wants to have. And I think that honestly there are probably some, and I know this is true because I've talked to them, there are some people very high up on the NSA who say if there's a silver lining in this, it's that it forced them to come forward and say this is who we are, this is what we do, to defend it and to argue in favor of it. And any of those capabilities that have been lost because of the Snowden disclosures, I know that the NSA is working very quickly to try and rebuild them.
Shane Harris, author of At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. This has been fascinating. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Our engineer was Nick Ivanov. Our producer is Anya Zalewski. I'm Doug Bernard. Join us again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.